Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.
It is my preference that the Democratic Party leads us forward in a way that is about standing up to special interests and in a way that advances campaign finance reform, in a way that fights for meaningful prescription drug reform, in a way that champions our environment, that recognizes the importance of jobs that pay, that will take on the banking system when they're trying to cheat consumers. But if the Democratic Party won't do that, then I will stand up to the Democratic Party.
Hello and welcome to Why Is This Happening? With me, your host, Chris Hayes. Well, if you know the freshman members of the Democratic Congress, you probably know a handful. I mean, most likely, if you were to say, okay, name one, it would be Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who is, I think, the most famous. She won that sort of remarkable primary upset over Joe Crowley. Then, of course, there is now the Squad, which has been sort of rendered iconic in large part to the president's horrifying attacks on them, including Ilhan Omar and Rashida Tlaib, who's in Detroit, and Ayanna Pressley, who is in Boston. Ilhan Omar is in Minneapolis. So those are some members of Congress you may have heard of. There's a whole bunch of others. We had Max Rose, who's a really fascinating guy on the program, who flipped a Republican district in Staten Island in Brooklyn, who you should check out our conversation with. And there's this one woman who is not, like, she's not part of the Squad, and I don't think she's famous for other reasons, except she's just really super good at grilling people in hearings. Now, you may not even know her name or which district she represents, but I bet you if you're listening to this, like, you've probably seen the viral footage of some bank CEO, like the Wells Fargo CEO, or Jamie Dimon getting up and being asked how much his tellers make, or the head of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which is supposed to be protecting consumers but has been turned into a kind of declawed agency under Trump, struggling to do, like, basic, the basic math of what a, like, APR, which is annualized calculation of interest. You can think about these moments where someone comes before the committee and there's this congresswoman who looks sort of, like, professorial and nice. She's, like, super nice. Just absolutely, like, gutting these people. And it's become, like, a microgenre of viral video in 2019, in the era of this Democratic House. And I thought it would be worthwhile to talk to the woman in question. Her name is Katie Porter. She's got a really fascinating story. So she's a freshwoman. I always do that. Tiffany's laughing at me. She's a freshman member of Congress. She's a freshman member of Congress. She won in California's 45th congressional district, which is in Orange County near Irvine. She's a law professor at the University of California near Irvine, or was a law professor. She had never been in politics, as you will hear in this conversation. Never run for office before, never really considered running for office, wasn't, like, the daughter of a politician. A lot of the ways that people find themselves in politics, just one of these people, one of these stories of the Trump era of kind of waking up and being like, I got to do something about where this country's going. I got to do something. She's also really interesting because she won a contested primaries. She was not the candidate in that swing district that the Democratic Party wanted to take on the Republican incumbent. There was another candidate they backed. So she had sort of two improbable victories back to back. She beat the establishment-backed Democrat in the primary to win the primary. And then there was a lot of questions of, like, oh, no, she beat the most electable candidate in the primary. Like, now we're not going to win the seat. And lo and behold, when all the votes were counted, she had, in fact, won the seat in Orange County, and she is now a member of Congress representing the 45th district. She is a really fascinating figure, as you're going to hear, with a really interesting backstory. And one of the things I think, when you think about where we are in the politics at this moment, so much of the politics revolves around, when people talk about, like, the swing voter, they're talking about, like, oh, the Republicans in the suburbs who don't like Trump, but they don't want single payer. Or when they talk about the industrial Midwest, like, there's these kinds of voters that are talked about in the abstract. But then there are actual politicians who represent voters that are the kinds of voters that political pundits talk about as, like, they're the key. Like, can we convince these people? And so one of the reasons I thought it was interesting to talk to Max Rose is to get his read. Like, he's in a frontline district. That's a contested district. It was a Republican district. His district voted for Donald Trump. he's got to deal with that fact as the brute political reality he navigates around. And he does it in a very Max Rose-ish way. Katie Porter is it on the other coast in a very different place culturally from Staten Island and Brooklyn. And she's got the same set of issues. Like, that district is not a deeply Democratic district. I think it went for Hillary Clinton by a very narrow margin. The woman that she defeated had won that district by huge amounts. It's been traditionally Republican. So she's got to deal with the political reality of her district. And she does it, as you will see, in a very Katie Porterish way. And so I think as you think about the politics of this moment, particularly amidst the conversation about will Democrats impeach or not, and Nancy Pelosi is concerned about the frontline districts, which are the most vulnerable Democrats, and what will Trump run against when he runs against the eventual Democratic nominee, and are Dems moving too far to the left, and all that stuff, I just find it really illuminating to just speak to and listen to people whose daily life is drenched in the politics of precisely this question. How do you navigate the politics of being a Democrat at the time of Donald Trump in a place that is not a 70-30 Democratic district? There is a lot of wisdom to glean from it, but there's also just a ton to learn about this moment in politics, because I think this moment in politics, and you will hear this from her, I don't think there's another moment in politics that would have produced Congresswoman Katie Porter, but I'm really glad that this moment in politics did. I think I said this to you the first time that I interviewed you on air, that I'd first encountered you on a blog back in the blogging days. And I thought maybe we'd talk a little bit just before you became a member of Congress. Like, where are you born? Where'd you grow up?
Yeah, I was born in Fort Dodge, Iowa. My parents lived in a little town called Eagle Grove. My mom taught high school, and my dad was an instructor at the community college. And when I was about two and a half, my brother was just about to be born. We moved to South Central Iowa to the farm where my dad had grown up, where my grandfather had grown up. The house was actually, it was a tiny little house. It was about 600 square feet, and it was built by my great-grandfather. And that's the house I spent time in as a child.
What was the sort of world like there? I mean, was there sort of an expectation growing up that you would go off and go to college?
My parents were both college educated, and on my mom's side, her parents were college educated. One was a home economics major and had been the county home economist.
Oh, wow.
And my grandfather on that same side was a veterinarian. So they had both gone to Iowa State. My parents had gone to Iowa State. My aunts and uncles had gone to Iowa State. Are you sensing a theme?
Yes.
So it was a big break with tradition when I went off to Yale, for sure. Yeah, I think my parents really valued education. They were both educators. But it was definitely true that I grew up in an area where a lot of people didn't go to college. A lot of people did 2 years and kind of terminal 2 years at community college.
I grew up in the Bronx, and then I went to this magnet school in New York City that exposed me to a certain kind of sort of like affluent, urbane, professional class of New York. And then I went to Brown, and even having been sort of acclimated to a certain kind of, you know, degree of sort of the American elite, like, I found Brown a bit of a culture shock at first. Like, I wonder what was Yale like coming from Iowa?
Yeah, so the real culture shock occurred for me in high school, because when I was 16, entering 11th grade, I went to Phillips Academy, a boarding school in Massachusetts.
Oh, you went to Oh, yeah, that's...
And so that was
a huge culture shock. That's a long way from the
farm. Yeah, I had never been east of the Mississippi River before. I mean, I had been in the Mississippi River, but that was literally, I'd never been to the other side of it even when I went to boarding school. And so that was a tremendous culture shock. From there, the leap to Yale was not
Oh, yeah. No, Phillips is probably a bit like more sort of rarefied than Yale, actually.
Yeah, I mean, it was definitely an incredible experience. But, you know, my path there was one largely driven by coincidence, good luck, some of the strength of the state universities in Iowa. So basically what happened was a researcher, a psychologist at Iowa State, got some grant funding to study gifted kids. And so she wrote letters to the school districts in Iowa and asked them to nominate a gifted kid to come and study at Iowa State for the summer.
Wow.
And I ended up taking the SAT in seventh grade and getting into this program. And it was completely free, which was really important at the time. The financial, this is 1987, the financial crisis, the farm crisis is in full swing. Nobody has any money, you know, my family included. And so I went to Iowa State. I ended up living in a dorm that my grandmother had lived in, did a college class with other gifted kids in the morning, and then in the afternoon they did psychology experiments on us. So personality tests, career aptitude, social skills. So
wow.
I'll never forget the career aptitude test. Something must have been a little off on that instrument because the vast majority of my gifted middle school friends and I all got the same career. We all got vending machine repairman. So, I mean, lawyer was like fourth or fifth on the list, so it wasn't like it wasn't in the list. But
on that experimental design,
yeah.
Could use a little
revisiting. Or maybe, Chris, it's a really satisfying career, and
right.
I just haven't found
right.
my actual calling. I mean, I reserve the right to think about what I might pursue after Congress.
It's so specific. So
I know.
I see. So through this sort of channel, then you somehow got recommended or
yeah.
connected to Philip somehow?
So they sent us, it was a longitudinal study, and so they sent us follow-up information. And one of the things they sent us was a booklet on opportunities for gifted kids. And I went through, and I wanted to go to another one of these summer experiences. My public school education was amazing in Iowa, but it was a very small school. There were 14 kids in my sixth grade. There were 42 when I got to the bigger school, the combined school for middle school and high school. And so I wanted to go to another summer camp and have another opportunity to learn and be with other kids. And so I wrote these little pre-printed postcards, the pre-stamped kind, and I wrote on them, please send me information. Katie Porter, Rural Route, you know, 149. And it turns out if you tell Andover that you want information, they assume you mean for the school year. I thought it was a summer camp. And so they sent me the information and I ended up, you know, it's a glossy brochure and it looked fun and I filled it out and I got in. I went on scholarship. And
wow.
I remember that first night, you know, being there, my roommate was from Naples, Florida, which is actually a town that in some ways is not unlike Irvine in some ways.
Yeah.
But, you know, she was describing her town and I was telling her about where I was from and she was talking about all the city programs and the landscaping the city was doing and the city pool and her junior high and, you know, she'd already taken all these years of French. And I just remember thinking, like, please let me pass. Please let me pass. And I wound up doing obviously well when I got into Yale. But that was a really important experience for me. And I will always be grateful to the donors, the people who made that experience possible.
You know, it's interesting talking to you. You know, a theme that I keep coming back to, and I spoke to your colleague Max Rose about a month back, is, you know, America can be very siloed. There's many ways in which there's a lot of distance between folks sort of socially, geographically. There's sort of class divisions, there are racial divisions. And it's a really, in some ways, unique and rare and important experience when people get to sort of move through different subcultures and parts of America in terms of how that creates the person you are and the vision you have and your ability for kind of empathy. I mean, how, do you think that's, in your case, just hearing you describe the small town Iowa to Phillips to Yale, like, how did that affect the person you became?
It absolutely had an impact. I mean, most directly, it had an impact on what I chose to study in college and then what I chose to study in law school. And so when I went off to Yale, I was an American studies major, but what I focused on within that was how Americans understand economic dislocation.
Hmm.
And in particular, the work of some anthropologists who were studying, you know, American anthropologists who were looking, for instance, at how did folks in Kenosha, who had worked at the Chrysler GM factory when it was shut down in the 80s, how did they understand that? Did they feel like they were victims? Did they feel like they were being taken advantage of? Did they feel like this was just part of the struggles of up and down life and part of American meritocracy? So I was very interested in that. After that, though, I taught eighth grade, which I absolutely loved. In Hong Kong, I took a trip around the world by myself for 6 months.
Wow.
There is no way parents should allow their children to do that. I just want to be on record that my parents are completely, completely fell down on the job.
Wait, how old are you when you took a trip around the world by yourself?
22.
Oh,
yeah, they were
You're a grown up.
Yeah, you don't know where I went and what I did. I mean, they don't either, and we should keep it that way for the sake of them.
Good
but,
God. Now I'm curious.
I mean, I went to Vietnam the year the embassy opened.
Wow.
And this was, of course, 1997, and so email was very kind of catch as you can. And yeah. So a month would go by and they wouldn't hear from me. And they apparently were fine with that.
Wow.
I mean, you know.
Good for your parents, actually.
Yeah. No, it was great. It was a great experience. And then I came back and I went to law school. And I had some inkling when I started law school that I might want to be a teacher, that I might want to be a professor. This was what, you know, my mom had taught high school. My dad had been a professor. I had loved my Yale education and learning. I went through law school really loving it, but not having found any one thing in the law that really captivated me. And to be a good academic, you have to love what you're studying, because the number of hours you're spending kind of on these tiny, what can seem like tiny issues.
Yeah.
I mean, you go deep, right, as an academic. Very different than my job in Congress, where it's often about the breadth of the issues that I'm studying. And so I took Elizabeth Warren's bankruptcy class. It met at 8 a.m. It was my third year of law school, and I can still tell you, you know, I sat in the front row next to my friend Barb, and you could feel when Elizabeth arrived.
Huh.
Like, you didn't need to turn around. You could just feel the energy come into the room. And she was a terrific teacher, and the first day lecture she gave is still really important to me. I have the notes from that first day lecture.
Wow.
I give a version of that first day lecture in my own bankruptcy classes when I teach. But what she talked about that first day is something that I'm still talking about today in Congress with folks like Jamie Dimon, which is, what do we do in a capitalist economy with the fact that there are both ups and downs? So capitalism does a great job of rewarding risk-taking, of rewarding those who are successful, of incentivizing that. But it doesn't, nothing about capitalism inherently tells us what we do when people stumble, when people take bad risks, when there are downturns. And there's that volatility aspect to capitalism that is part of its genius, but we do have to grapple with that downside.
You know, it's funny you say that. I want to talk more about what Warren was like a professor, but I just was reading the New Yorker did a profile of Alan Dershowitz, and
I also had him.
You did, right? Of course, a small world.
I will not give him rave reviews. He gave me my only B, and I'm still bitter.
Oh, that's amazing.
That B stands for bitter.
But there's this line in there that was just, to me, sort of perfectly embody this, the kind of too big to fail logic of American capitalism, cushions for people at the top and nothing for people at the bottom, which is that Jeffrey Epstein convinces some hedge fund manager he knows to, like, let Dershowitz park a little money in the hedge fund, even though he doesn't have quite enough that would normally go in. And then said hedge fund has huge losses in a year. And Epstein calls the manager to ream him out and basically being like, you're making Alan whole. And I just thought to myself, man, like, is there ever a more perfect microcosm of the way it actually functions at the top, which is that if you get caught up in the housing bust through no fault of your own, like, you're SOL. But if you're, like, a well-connected Harvard law professor who gets his investment wiped out, like, the hedge fund manager refunds you.
No, and I mean, there's actually something really fundamental there that I've grappled with a lot in my work as a consumer advocate, and, you know, working on issues like credit card fees and payday lending and student loan debt and all of these issues, which is that it is a fundamental human impulse that people don't like to feel cheated.
Yeah.
But if you really want to see fury about being cheated or losing money or being on the downside of capitalism, it's when people at the top have that experience. And so, you know, I remember when I was working for our now Senator Kamala Harris, but our then Attorney General, and I was working on the mortgage foreclosures across California and trying to help families either navigate to relief or make the hard decision to let the home go. A lot of these families had been struggling for 2 years, 3 years, 4 years to hang on to this house. They knew that if they let this one go, they might never become homeowners again. And those families were always, as much as the banks were wronging them, they had a lot of empathy for. You'd say, you've got to fill the paperwork out again. I'm so sorry, you know, that the bank has lost it again, or they want more documentation. We'll help you with the forms. And then I would get these calls from these sort of like hedge fund managers in La Jolla or Marin, and they would be like, I'm underwater on my third home, and what are you going to do about it?
Yeah.
And, you know, one of the things about the depth of the recession with the foreclosure crisis was that it really did touch a group of people who really hadn't had economic hardship before, and they didn't like it very much. And I think that was part of how we generated the momentum to enact the Dodd-Frank law, was that there was the sense that this economic recession was so big and so sweeping that it didn't just hurt first-time homebuyers. It didn't just hurt low-income communities. It actually resulted in massive losses for those kinds of titans of the banking industry.
It's a great point. There's a lot of anger at the big banks from people with a lot of money and social capital that they felt like they've been screwed by the big banks.
No, I mean, when we had our hearing with the big banks, I actually thought that my Republican colleagues, and with Wells Fargo in particular, I actually thought some of my Republican colleagues were significantly harder on the banks than some of my Democratic colleagues. It was sort of eye-opening to me.
Did Warren become kind of a mentor? I mean, it's interesting to hear you talk about this because, you know, what you're talking about is some of the same things, obviously, that she worked on, and both from the sort of consumer finance and bankruptcy, like that, clearly that class really influenced you.
Absolutely. And I went on to teach that area of law. She did become a mentor to me. I helped gather the data. I flew around the country helping to gather the data that ultimately was used by Elizabeth and some of her colleagues to write the study on bankruptcies that are related to medical illness and injury and medical debt. So it was incredibly important. She's, you know, a wonderful, wonderful teacher, a wonderful mentor. I mean, my daughter is named Elizabeth. I mean, we're close.
Have you endorsed her?
I have not.
Huh, why not?
Because I'm also very, very close to Kamala, and Kamala is my California senator. She represents me in the United States Senate, and I'm very proud of both of them, and I would be delighted to endorse them both right this very minute, but they are really both dead serious about their capacity, their desire, their willingness to lead this country forward, and I have tremendous respect for both of them.
So you then become a law professor yourself, right?
Yes, I became a law professor.
And your area of research is what?
Is bankruptcy and commercial law, and then ultimately consumer law. And I remember at the time I was getting ready to become a law professor, it was about 2004, 2005, the economy's booming, everything's great, there's, you know, nothing to see here, says Alan Greenspan over and over again. And I remember telling Elizabeth that I wanted to teach consumer law. And she said, well, you know, that's like not really a thing. Like, there isn't really a field there. There aren't any scholars. That's, no one really does that. That has changed. And the recession, of course, helped that change. But this idea of kind of understanding our rights as consumers, I think, is on the upswing. I think you see it with people's reactions to both the Equifax and the Capital One data privacy breaches. I think you increasingly see people bringing a kind of consumer mindset to healthcare. Like, I paid this premium and you don't cover my claims. Like, that's wrong. But, you know, this kind of identity as a consumer was on the wane sort of in the 90s. That wasn't a way that people thought about themselves. They were more caught up in thinking about themselves as employees, as women or men, right, in sort of these other kinds of social movements. But I think the recession really triggered this new sense of identity that being a consumer is one of the most fundamental ways that we engage with our society and with our economy.
And then you decided to engage with society by running for office. And I want to talk about the decision to do that right after this.
Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.
Sometimes it takes a different approach to help you unlock your true potential. With Capella University's game-changing FlexPath learning format, you gain relevant skills you can apply to your career right away. Earn your degree from an accredited university and be confident in the quality of your education. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu. Capella University is accredited by the Higher Learning Commission. Learn more at capella.edu/accreditation.
You ever think about politics or running for office during your time as a law professor?
I never thought about running for office until Donald Trump was elected. I thought several times, and I was invited several times to go to Washington to work with Elizabeth. I was invited by Elizabeth to come work with her when she started the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. I interviewed for a job at the Federal Reserve to be in charge of their consumer affairs. So the idea of doing policy work was definitely something I had thought about. But I always thought that I would apply for this job and be selected on merit, or I would be appointed. But the idea of being a candidate and being kind of popularly elected was completely foreign to me.
Where were you teaching law?
At the University of California, Irvine,
right,
which is the area I still represent.
Right. So you live in or around Irvine now.
Yep.
Donald Trump's elected. You're a professor there. You've done some work for the Attorney General of California, Kamala Harris. And I'm so curious about that mental journey from, like, I never thought about running for office to I'm going to do it.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. On the campaign trail, I didn't get asked about this very often, and I didn't really tell the story, the intimate story of kind of how I personally made this decision until election night. And on election night, we were losing. And we continued to lose for the next day or two, 5 days, 6 days. I was still losing about day, I don't know, 8 or 9 or 10.
Yeah, you were one of the last ones to come in, right?
Yeah, I was the third last race in the country to be called. They just took a long time. There were a lot of ballots and very high turnout. But so because I was talking to this audience of people who had worked so hard to get me elected, and they were so disappointed that we were behind on election night, I'm not sure anybody really paid attention as I was telling them very heartfelt personal things about like kind of how I came to this decision. But, you know, my attitude after the election was really, well, you know, I'll wait. I will wait 4 years. I can wait. Maybe Elizabeth will run for president, or maybe Kamala will appoint me to something, or maybe I'll decide I want to be a judge, or we'll just see what the universe holds. But my job as a citizen, as somebody with policy knowledge and expertise, was just to wait for the call, to wait for the opportunity. And I remember talking about this with my boyfriend, and he just looked at me like I was nuts. And he was like, why would you ever wait around for somebody else to make it possible for you to make a difference? If you want to make a difference, go do it. Like, why are you waiting for even these amazing women like Elizabeth or Kamala to enable you? You have that capacity in you. You should run for office. That was really the epiphany. And I literally started by, I knew who our congressperson was, but I literally started by kind of Googling like how much she'd won by. And I was like, ooh, 17 points. Ooh. That does not seem close.
That's not promising.
I was not a political expert, but even to me, that I do understand math. And I was like, wow, 17 points. But I also knew, living in this area and running this huge Cub Scout pack, which I absolutely love doing, and 3 kids in school here and teaching at the largest employer in the area, I just had a real sense that my friends and neighbors and the students of this area weren't a good fit for kind of Donald Trump's America. And that, of course, once the election returns fully came in and we had the district by district analysis, we learned that Hillary Clinton had actually carried this district by 5 points. And so that was sort of the opening when I went to kind of start my race. People said it was hopeless. People continued to say it was hopeless right until I had won. I mean, while the ballots were being counted, my opponent was still whipping votes to be the chair of the National Republican Campaign Committee.
That's amazing.
While I was beating her. And I, meanwhile, what was I doing? I was cleaning my house because there was like nothing else to do. And my house was a mess after 2 years of campaigning.
Can we go back to that moment where your boyfriend says, like, why shouldn't you? There's so much there about gender and running for office. I mean, we have all these sorts of studies about what are the impediments to more women running for office and being elected. And there's lots, right? There's things having to do with sort of like social capital and donor networks. But there just seems like there's a lot of sort of like the structured and gendered acculturation of women to think about what their own ambition should be is a big part of the story as well. And it's just so interesting to me hear you, like, your boyfriend be like, no, you should run. It's like that kind of, like, I don't know, for lack of a better word, like culturally cultivated male hubris.
No, but it's
seems
true.
Like a big part of what goes into making these intimate decisions that are really difficult about running for office that end up with these crazy gender disparities.
Well, and I think being a candidate, much more than other things I had done, law professors, particularly in commercial law and business law, that's very male dominated. And so I had been in kind of this male dominated field. I mean, when Elizabeth Warren left academics to go into government, I mean, that was like a quarter of the women law professors of bankruptcy, like at the top of the field, kind of went away. I mean, it was a noticeable suck kind of outward of women in leadership there. But I think being a candidate is a kind of personal vulnerability and standing up. And I think it felt to me like I was asking people to think I was best. And instead, my job as a woman was to show people that I was the best. It was just to do the best work. It was just to write the best article or work the hardest. But this idea of being a candidate is a lot about standing up and affirmatively saying,
I'm the best.
I am the best. And that felt uncomfortable to me. Yeah. And it wasn't that I didn't think I wasn't good or talented or hadn't worked hard. It was just that there's a kind of declarative aspect of being a candidate that I think can be kind of culturally uncomfortable for women. And I think we're pushing back at that a lot, understanding more. But we know for women that most women don't run unless they're asked to run,
right,
unless they're told to run. This doesn't come to them as a bolt of lightning. And I do think we're seeing that change. But for me, there was something about, you know, I remember someone saying to me, like, don't you think you're better than your opponent? And I was like, yeah. And they were like, well, then why are you so worried about the outcome of this election? Hmm. Right. And of course, I could give the many answers like, I represent more Republicans than I do Democrats, and I'm a Democrat. That would seem like a good reason to be worried. I had other real reasons to be worried. The country had just elected Donald Trump, and I'm running on a campaign that is about standing up to Donald Trump. So, I mean, I think I had some legitimate anxieties, but some of it was kind of personal at the end.
You have three kids, and you've got a job, and you're running for Congress. What surprised you most about campaigning?
I think how fun it is, actually. So there are aspects of it that are not fun. There's just no way around the fact that raising the money, particularly as a first-time candidate, particularly as a woman, particularly as someone from modest means, I mean, that just requires a grueling amount of effort. But I think it was really how much fun it was to learn and how much I learned on the campaign trail. So here I was kind of an expert in consumer bankruptcy and consumer law and mortgage servicing and these things. And then all of a sudden as a candidate, I'm having to learn a whole bunch about things like project labor agreements and workforce agreements and Davis-Bacon labor statutes and environmental issues and issues in healthcare and foreign policy. And so all of the people, and I'm fortunate to represent an incredibly well-educated, incredibly talented community. And so all of those people who stepped up to teach me and educate me, not only about what they know professionally, but about their own life experiences and what their life experiences have taught them, I just soaked up all that knowledge
and
really
loved
it.
Yeah. You sort of mentioned parenthetically a few sentences ago about a campaign that was sort of focused on standing up to Trump. And there's sort of interesting conversation that's happening now in Democratic politics about, to sort of oversimplify, this kind of balance between focusing on, you know, kitchen table issues, as people sort of invoke, and, you know, we're going to protect your health care and here's how we're going to deliver a better life for you and your family, versus mounting a resistance to this president and all he represents and wants to do. And how you struck that balance in the messaging in your own race.
I think a lot of that, kind of how I think about that, just grows out of my work. So, you know, I have spent my career thinking about how hard it is for families to make ends meet and why that is, how they cope when they do struggle, how we can better help them avoid getting into those situations. And I've thought about that in my own life, right? So how am I going to make ends meet after my divorce, having, you know, two households to kind of support, things like that. And so I think from my position on the Financial Services Committee, with the questioning that I've done of folks like Jamie Dimon at JPMorgan Chase, of Ben Carson at HUD, of the head of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, I've really shown that I get the economic struggles, the financial struggles, and the personal fears that people have about whether they're going to be able to hang on, whether they're going to be able to retire, whether there's going to be a good job waiting for their children. I get those things on a very personal level and also from my professional work. And I see those struggles as about what kind of economy are we going to have for our kids? What kind of opportunities are we going to have? How are we going to take care of our seniors in this next generation as the baby boomers, this huge generation of people retire? I don't see those things as different necessarily from resisting Trump, because right. some of the actions that President Trump is taking are really setting back American families. So driving up the deficit is a huge problem for the next generation. Some of these trade wars are causing families to feel a lot of financial pain. The utter failure of Betsy DeVos to do anything competent at the Department of Education is creating a lot of hardship around student loans. And so I see kind of resisting Trump as resisting some of the economic hardship that his presidency is creating.
And that's been very clear, I think, in your so far brief, but I think quite, if I may say, impressive congressional career. But when you were running, right, like if you said to me, if I got in an elevator with candidate Katie Porter and you were giving me your 60-second pitch to me, sort of undecided voter, like what was the Katie Porter message?
I think it was one of standing up to special interests, of really being kind of from the middle class and for the middle class.
Yeah.
And so just really understanding that I get what it's like to make ends meet. I understand that this is hard. I understand that sometimes corporations are making this harder for us. I've gone toe-to-toe, and you've heard both Elizabeth Warren and Kamala Harris say this, and it's true about both of them, but it's also true about me. I'll never forget when I worked for Kamala, the first meeting I had with Bank of America. And it was in Los Angeles, and I had been appointed to help with this mortgage foreclosure settlement and help make sure families got help. And at the time, I had been on the job like maybe a week and a half. I had zero staff, and the Department of Justice in California was still trying to figure out how they were going to get me, you know, a budget and things like this. And Bank of America wants to have a meeting. And so I say to the only staff I have at that time, who's my assistant, my secretary, who was a 5-foot Vietnamese woman, young woman, Lynn, you're coming with me to meet with Bank of America. And she said, but I don't know anything about banking. And I said, they don't have to know that. Don't say anything. It's just important that we, you know, they're going to have like 10 people around this conference table, and we have to bring a little like,
you know,
strength.
It's so
funny here
you
we come,
is,
like these two women into this meeting with all of these banking executives, and we came out the winner.
It's a funny thing about adulthood that I've realized, like how many people you have in the meeting matter a lot. Like, it's like a real power thing about, like, if you're solo versus three people, but if you bring three people and they only have two, like, it does really matter to have a little backup.
Oh, I mean, this is the entire story of Congress, right? I mean, this is, like, deeply important to understanding how Congress really functions, which is, like, things like where you sit and how many years you've been there, and these things all matter, and how many members are on this committee, and the number of votes, and things like this. I mean, it's interesting, is I think I really focused my energy on the questioning that I do in the hearings. And part of the reason for that is a lot of these other tools to help people are driven by seniority. And
right.
I don't have any.
That's
I mean,
a great point.
I have a little.
Everyone gets to question. Not everyone gets to do a lot of other things because
everyone
of the seniority.
Gets the 5 minutes.
Yeah.
And if you've been on the committee, you know, 30 years, you get 5 minutes. If you've been on the committee 30 days, you get 5 minutes. And so this I saw as one of the real opportunity I had to kind of find my voice, to ask the questions that I thought were on the minds of my constituents and American families, and to kind of push on some of the things that I think are wrong, or we need to be addressing, or we need to be thinking more about and grappling with.
You know, what's really interesting, as I sit here and listen to you and your sort of theory of the case here, and thinking about Max Rose, you know, one of the things that I think ends up happening in political commentary is sort of a fight over like there being one true way for like one true way vis-a-vis political messaging, one true way for the Democratic Party or any party to sort of pursue its both communication efforts and its governing agenda. And it's just interesting that, you know, Max Rose and you both are freshman members of Congress. You both flipped districts. Your district was a Hillary district. His was Trump. But you both had to take out Republican incumbents. You're both frontline members of Congress. Like, you're going to have a tough reelect probably, or, you know, it'll be contested most likely. And you have very different ways of approaching that, both of which seem effective in their own right. You represent different constituencies and you're different people with different life experiences. And it just strikes me how much we focus on, like, oh, there's got to be one way to do this. But listening to you just makes me realize that that's maybe not the case, that you've got a very authentic vision of how this works that fits your community quite well, that might be different than every other one of the 31 frontline members.
Well, and I think actually, I mean, Max is a good friend of mine in Congress, and I can tell you why. It's because Max is Max.
Exactly.
Like,
yes.
I am Katie Porter.
Yes. I mean, and that's what I mean. Like, what you are describing and the way you went in that race is, here's my experience and here's what I believe in and here's my theory of the case that really matches who I am and what I believe in. And Max, I think, did very much the same thing in his New York district. In neither case, both of you ran races that were authentic to really what you do believe and how you see the world and sold that to your districts.
Yeah. And I think that's one of the reasons that we work well together in Congress. I mean, Max takes votes sometimes and I'm like, what are you doing? And he feels the same way about me. But the reason that Max and I work so well together, I think, is two things. One is that we're very comfortable with who we are. We have lived our lives. We have had these kinds of interesting experiences. And you know, Max's personal story of military service, it's different than my story. But we're really comfortable talking about what we've gone through, what we've learned, the challenges we faced, and why we think that we can use those experiences to represent people well in Congress. The second thing about Max that I do think is a common thread across a lot of the freshman class that was talked about a lot when we were being elected, and then suddenly when we got to Washington is being reported on a lot less, and that is standing up to corporations, the anti-corruption platform, the not taking corporate PAC money. I mean, Max and I talk about those issues. We approach things like prescription drug pricing and some of those things from a very, very similar position, which is we believe that we need powerful, fearless voices who will argue for what is right, not for what is easy. And we've had experiences in our lives where we've had to do that. And so even though they're very different experiences, there's kind of a feistiness, kind of a populism, kind of an energy to Max and me temperamentally that makes us actually, I think, two of the more similar members, even though there are aspects of our lives and of our races and of the areas we represent that are very different.
I think we played this video on our show of you coming out in favor of an impeachment inquiry, and you were one of the first frontline members to come out. Tell me about the thinking that went into that.
So really for me, it was reading the Mueller report, and I really didn't think about or talk about impeachment at all in my campaign. It didn't come up. And my view was just it would be absolutely inappropriate to presume the findings or not that Mueller may make. And so until the Mueller report came up, I just viewed this as completely premature. I had no comment other than to say I supported the special counsel having independent authority to conduct the investigation, and I had confidence in him. After the report came out and I read it, I began to look at the Constitution and start to kind of think about, what does it really say about impeachment? What does it mean to begin an impeachment inquiry? What's my role in this in the House of Representatives? I just felt like I needed to be honest. Once my mind was made up that impeachment was appropriate, I felt that I absolutely needed to be honest with my constituents about that. So I definitely represent an area where not everyone agrees with me. That is true on every issue, but it's true on impeachment. I have Democrats who are opposed to impeachment in my district, and I have some Republicans who are for it. I mean, people are struggling with a lot of these issues across traditional party lines. So for my ask to my constituents was not that they agree with me, but that they hear me out, that they listen to what I'm saying, that they respect that I have really grappled with this and I am really trying to do what I think is the right thing to do for our country. And it really boils down to the Mueller report is very clear that there is substantial evidence of four or more acts of obstruction of justice. I thought a lot about what a high crime and misdemeanor was, the history of the impeachment statute, the kind of building blocks of our democracy. And I think obstruction of justice, particularly multiple instances of it, is really, really a terrible offense for a president who's charged with safeguarding our democracy to have engaged in.
You know, it's interesting you put it that way, because I think one thing that happens in politics is people have like their private views and their public views. And I just think it's real.
I can't do that.
Yeah,
for better
I think
or
it's
worse.
Real. It's very dangerous for a too much. I think it's just dangerous for a space to open up too far. The other thing I will say, I think people have a lot of cynicism about politicians, but actually a thing that I think people undercount as a theory of why politicians do the thing they do is like they actually believe in it. I see people all the time imputing to politicians like they're not saying this because they want to get reelected. It's like it may just be that that's what they think on this topic. And I'm curious what you think, because you're someone who is fresh on Capitol Hill. Your read of the degree to which, like, has anything surprised you or challenged the mental model that you had going in of how members of Congress make decisions, what sort of confluence of factors determine their positions, and what you've actually seen up close?
Yeah, I mean, I think impeachment is actually a good example of people coming out really because they believed it.
Yeah.
And that has taken different people different amounts of time. And that's because people make decisions differently. People consume information differently. Kind of, I think most of those decisions have been driven by, at least the decisions that followed the Mueller report, have really been driven by people's convictions and their beliefs. Watching kind of what happened in the wake of the Mueller report with Trump directing witnesses not to appear before Congress, for example. I do think sometimes, though, in Congress, I am a little surprised by the degree to which people are nervous about challenging whatever the orthodoxy is. And I guess for me, and this is something I think I have in common with Max Rose, is I didn't get here in an orthodox way. I never run for office. I ran in this district where the incumbent had just, you know, 17 points, 19 points, huge victories. I had a very, very tough primary. I was not endorsed by the Democratic Party in my primary. So I was like actually uphill against the Democratic Party during my race. And so, you know, the fact that then when they get to Washington, it's like some of those same independent streaks and independent minds and independent candidates that I think helped create this big majority for the Democrats. Some of those people now are like, what's the party position? And right. I don't think that's probably a good idea. It just isn't how I personally work. I'm really interested in what's the right answer. And I do think the Democratic Party has more right answers than the Republican Party. And that's why I'm a Democrat. But, you know, I had an interesting conversation with my colleague, Justin Amash, who has recently declared himself to be an independent. And I saw him and I said, you know, Justin, you look so happy. Huh. And because there are not a lot of happy faces on the floor of the House of Representatives. And I said, Justin, you look so happy. And he said, I'm so happy. He said, I can vote my conscience without having to feel that pressure to conform to the party. And so when I say to people in my campaign, I am willing to stand up to leaders of both parties, it is my preference that the Democratic Party leads us forward in a way that is about standing up to special interests, in a way that advances campaign finance reform, in a way that fights for meaningful prescription drug reform, in a way that champions our environment, that recognizes the importance of jobs that pay, that will take on the banking system when they're trying to cheat consumers. But if the Democratic Party won't do that, then I will stand up to the Democratic Party. And that is that kind of streak of kind of stubbornness that probably partly grows out of my having been in these David versus Goliath battles with banks my whole career.
Katie Porter is a freshman congresswoman from California's 45th district, which is around Irvine, California, which is where she lives. Really great to get to know you a little better. Thank you so much for taking time.
Thank you.
Once again, my great thanks to Congresswoman Katie Porter. You can type her name into YouTube and see some of those viral grillings that I talked about. I suppose if we were a different kind of podcast, we would just produce that for you. Like, it occurred to me, I was sitting here in the intro and almost it occurred to me, like, should I play my phone into the microphone for her grilling Jamie Dimon? I was like, that seems like sort of a bad hack. So there's a way, I think, to do that. I don't know how any of these machines work, but there's also a universe in which we're the kind of podcast that we did that. Maybe that's the kind of podcast we'll be in the future. Right now, Tiffany just rolled her eyes. That's, yeah, right now we don't have a staff, so it's hard to do that. I got to wrap this up so I can go do our show. But great thanks to Congresswoman Katie Porter, who also like waited around for like 20 minutes of technical difficulties. I'm so sorry. That was super embarrassing. Sorry about that, Congresswoman. As always, we'd love to hear your feedback. Got great feedback from our conversation with Suketu Mehta on migration and people's migration stories. I was really, I was struck by the chord that that conversation struck with people, which I was really psyched to hear. And I really re-listened to it while I was on an electric scooter in Brooklyn. Maybe not the safest, but I found it like really moving to listen to him again. So if you missed that last week, it's a really good conversation, particularly germane in the wake of the mass murder that happened in El Paso. You can tweet us with the hashtag withpod. You can send us emails at withpod@gmail.com, particularly if you want to annoy Tiffany Champion. Send a lot of those. In fact, if you have an email, maybe just break it up line by line and just send each line as a separate email. I think it would really be appreciated in the old inbox there. Why Is This Happening is presented by MSNBC and NBC News, produced by the All In team, and features music by Eddie Cooper. You can see more of our work, including links to things we mentioned here, by going to NBCNews.com/Why Is This Happening.
Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.